Driving a new car is very exciting, but shopping for it can be among the more intimidating, nerve-wracking experiences a consumer faces. Earlier today, the Center for Auto Safety released lists of the best and worst 1988 cars, as rated by my guest, Jack Gillis. Gillis compiles this analysis for his annual publication, The Car Book, which is a guide for people in the market for a new car. He's also updated his companion volume, The Used Car Book. Both include everything from crash and repair ratings to price comparisons and showroom shopping strategies. Gillis first developed the car book in 1980 for the Department of Transportation. He's now Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America. I spoke to him from the NPR Bureau in New York, and he told me his picks for the best 1988 cars, but first he outlined the standards he used to rate them.
Well, we look at five categories. We look at crash test performance, fuel economy, repair costs, insurance costs. That's something you often forget about while you're in the showroom. And then this year, for the first time, we're including in our ratings program warranty ratings. That's whether or not the automobile manufacturers have given that particular car an average or a good or a poor warranty.
Okay, let's look at the cars that you chose as some of the best cars for 1988. Why don't we start with subcompact, if you could run through the list.
Well, that's important because we do categorize the cars by weight because weight is still an important consideration in terms of safety. In the subcompact category, the Chevrolet Nova, which is a joint venture product between GM and Toyota, Dodge Colt, Ford Escort, Mazda 323, and the Volkswagen Golf are all great choices for subcompacts.
Now, I notice what's absent in that subcompact list is either Toyotas or Hondas. You do have the Toyota MR2, but there's not many foreign cars in general.
Well, one of the reasons for that is because we can only rate cars for which we have information in all five categories. And unfortunately, the government has seriously delayed its crash test program. So, as you noted, there are some Hondas that are missing from this category. I expect that when they are finally crash tested, such cars as the Honda Civic and the Honda Prelude will do very well, and then they will then become good choices. But right now, we really don't know how they perform in crash tests.
Okay, let's look at compact.
Dodge Aries, Plymouth Reliant, Lee Iacocca's K cars are at the top of our list. And then some GM products, the Chevrolet Cavalier, the Olds Frienza, and the Pontiac Sunbird. Again, all cars that do well in such things as crash tests, fuel economy, repair cost, and have good warranties.
Now, again, all those cars are American cars. Is this part of a Buy American philosophy, or is it an absence of information about foreign cars, or are the foreign cars not performing well?
Well, when we look at the cars every year, we notice, and we have noticed over the past 3 years, a dramatic improvement in the quality and manufacture of U.S.-built cars. We still haven't closed the gap yet with our Japanese counterparts yet, but we are getting there. Again, one of the things that we look at is overall costs of maintaining the cars and insurance costs. And in those two areas, U.S. cars are doing better and better. Still, the all-time leaders in terms of low repair costs, as a general rule of thumb, would be such manufacturers' products as those that come from Toyota and Honda.
Okay, intermediate cars.
Well, again, we're talking about, we have some more U.S. cars here, the Buick Century, the Chevrolet Celebrity, Chrysler product, the Plymouth Caravelle, the Pontiac 6000 back again from GM, and then probably my favorite for the all-around safest car on the road today, the Volvo DL.
And finally, large cars.
Well, for those of you who are still looking for that traveling living room, there's some good choices out there. And they include the Chevrolet Caprice, the Ford LTD Crown Victoria, and the Mercury Grand Marquis. One interesting point about these three very large cars is that they have virtually remained unchanged now for about 8 years. So the manufacturers are really getting them right.
Now, in several of the new cars, there are twins. The car is made by two different manufacturers, or it's made by an American manufacturer and by a Japanese manufacturer. Are the twins 100% comparable?
Virtually 100% comparable. In many cases, such as with some of the products made by Mitsubishi for Chrysler, the only difference in the new car is the nameplate. One of the things that we tell consumers when shopping around for a new car is to consider these twins. For example, the Pontiac 6000 is virtually the same car as the Buick Century. You may find that the Pontiac 6000 will come at a lower price, or you can negotiate a better price for that particular car.
There are several innovations in the 1988 cars. More cars are having the option of four-wheel steering. What exactly is four-wheel steering, and do you think it's an important thing to have for the average driver?
Well, there's no question that four-wheel steering is the way of the future. It is currently available on a very limited number of Japanese cars. And essentially, what four-wheel steering offers is two things. First of all, better handling in high-speed turning. With all four wheels turning and the rear wheels turning very slightly into the curve, you are going to be able to maintain better control over the car in a high-speed turn. Probably the most advantageous part of four-wheel steering, though, for the average driver, is the fact that you can now park the car, parallel park the car, in very small spots. So for anyone who drives the car in the city, that's a tremendous advantage. It's still a new innovation, and we don't expect it to be used on a widespread basis for at least 3 or 4 years.
New innovations always make a lot of consumers a little nervous because you don't know if it's perfected yet. Are the four-wheel drive cars, is the four-wheel drive perfected enough so that it's worth investing in at this point?
There's no question about the fact that four-wheel drive is here to stay. In fact, I'm predicting that we'll have mainly four-wheel drive cars on the road far before we'll have four-wheel steering. The only inherent drawback with four-wheel drive is the fact that many of the vehicles that have four-wheel drive are what we call off-the-road vehicles, such as the Jeep and the Suzuki Samurai, and these have very short wheelbases, and they tend to turn over very easily.
Now, what about four-wheel steering, which you just brought up? What is that, and do you think it's an important option to go for?
Well, no, I don't think it's an important option. I think you alluded to the fact that you should wait a few years before you jump into one of these new options, and you're absolutely correct. I don't recommend that consumers buy cars with four-wheel steering this year, and probably not next year either. But 3 years from now, when it becomes tested and the manufacturing of four-wheel steering becomes more consistent, then it's probably an option that you should consider very seriously.
In the protection area, some cars are coming with airbag protection. And I think it's mostly the more high-priced cars that have that option now.
That's right. This year, the U.S. Department of Transportation is requiring that 1/4 of all the cars sold in the United States have some form of automatic crash protection. And this comes in three forms. The airbags, which you mentioned earlier, which is my favorite and I think the most effective form of automatic crash protection. But it unfortunately is only available mainly in the higher-priced European cars. And then two other that are more popular and less expensive. They're forms of automatic belts. Basically, these two belts come in the form of motorized, which many of you may have already experienced, many listeners have already experienced, with a little motor that brings the belt gently around your body when you sit in the car, and then when you open the door, it gently takes the belt away. The other form, and I think it's particularly important to note that this is mainly on General Motors cars, is a belt that is not motorized, that's attached to the outside of the door. When the door swings open, the belt pulls away, and you're almost presented with almost a spider web. You don't know whether to step over these belts or get underneath them or whatever. And I fully believe that General Motors has purposely designed this system to turn consumers off to this important form of automatic crash protection.
What is the advantage of a motorized belt? Assuming that you have a memory and that you want to use a seatbelt and you can buckle yourself up manually, why would you want a motorized one?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, statistically speaking, only 15 to 25% of us buckle up on a regular basis, even though states are passing safety belt laws all over the country. And secondly, automatic crash protection is like an automatic sprinkler system in a building. It's always there when you need it, but you don't have to depend on your own memory to use it on a regular basis. And I think there's sort of a philosophy out there in America that, gee, if I want to kill myself in an automobile crash, that's my right. Why force me to pay extra for this form of automatic crash protection? Well, the bottom line is it costs society far more if you do kill yourself than if you stay alive. So it's really a cost-beneficial product for society as a whole.
More and more, well, let me reintroduce you, Jack, before we continue. My guest is Jack Gillis, and he's the Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America. He's just completed new editions of The Car Book, which is a guide to shopping the new 1988 cars, and The Used Car Book, which is a guide to shopping for used cars in the year of 1988. More and more cars are coming with fuel injection instead of carburation. How do the two systems compare, and what are the benefits, what are the trade-offs for each for consumers?
Well, the good news is that the fuel injection systems, which are generally electronic, are far more efficient and less likely to break down. That's the good news.
Less likely to break down than carburation, or than they used to be.
No, well, yes, right, than they used to be when they were first introduced. But then the carburation systems, which are, by their nature, mechanical devices and therefore more prone to break down. That's the good news. The bad news is that the average mom-and-pop mechanic who used to be able to do practically everything to your car is no longer able to maintain certain components in the car, which forces you to go back to the dealership, pay more for typical repairs, and in fact, you're not necessarily going to get repairs. You're going to get what I call replacements. Today's cars are replaced rather than repaired, so that when the repairs are necessary, they're going to be far more expensive. However, they should be less frequent.
Do you recommend fuel injection?
Well, it's not like a lot of us have a choice right now. Practically every time a new model is introduced today, it comes with some form of electronic fuel injection. The older cars that we talked about, in fact, the Chevrolet Caprice, the Ford LTD, Crown Victoria, some of those cars their engines are now being equipped with electronic fuel injection. So it's not like we have a choice, but I don't think the consumers need to be afraid of it, like I suggested they should be 3 or 4 years ago.
But you don't think they're necessarily missing the boat if they choose carburation over fuel injection?
Not at all.
Are there any other 1988 innovations that you think we should discuss?
Well, I think probably the biggest news for 1988 is the increased competition in the area of warranties.
Mm-hmm.
Automobile manufacturers are finally competing in an area which has some direct bottom-line benefit to the average consumer, and that is the warranty. We're keeping our cars longer and longer. The average price of a 1988 car is over $14,000, so that means we want this car to last for a long time. When in the past competition has focused mainly on moonroofs and color-keyed interiors, it's now focusing in this area of warranties. We're seeing that the U.S. warranties now are coming close to the European, which have always been the leader in offering the best warranties, and even the Japanese, which traditionally have had the worst warranties, are coming around, and Toyota and Mazda for 1988 have introduced excellent warranties.
What is the difference in the length of warranty between a good and a poor warranty?
Well, there's two things that are important in terms of shopping for a warranty. One is, how long is that powertrain coverage? And we've all heard Lee Iacocca spouting forth about how they have the longest powertrain warranty in the industry. And that's very important, and it's in fact true. However, the powertrain is only one component of the car. The other type of warranty is called the basic warranty. And the longer warranties on such cars as Mercedes go for as long as 48 months. The Toyota now has introduced a 36-month warranty. And that offers bumper-to-bumper protection. And the reason why that's important is because those items that are going to be most expensive to repair and most likely to fail, such as electric windows and other gadgetry, are covered, whereas they're not covered on these longer Chrysler warranties.
The foreign cars have traditionally been less expensive in some categories than American cars, but the American dollar has been fluctuating like crazy for the past few months. How is that affecting the price of foreign cars now?
Well, foreign cars are going to continue to increase in price, but I think what's important to note here is that we were going to have fewer and fewer so-called truly foreign cars. Honda now is gearing up to build a wide number of models here in the U.S., so is Toyota. Nearly every major Japanese manufacturer will be building cars here in the U.S., so that's going to do a lot to equalize the price between so-called domestic and foreign cars.
Now, some people will tell you that if you have a choice of getting the Japanese-built version of the car or the American-built version, to go for the Japanese-built version because they have better quality control. I had heard that from several people. You know how you hear things word of mouth. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Absolutely not. In fact, we, as a case in point, we took a good close look at the American-built Honda Accord and compared it with the Japanese-built Honda Accord. The fit and finish, the quality of assembly, and every feature of the car was every bit as good as its Japanese counterpart, which just goes to show you that U.S. workers can, in fact, build great cars. One of the key problems that the industry has not been that U.S. workers can't build good cars, is that management has chosen not to build quality into the assembly process. When management does that, U.S. workers have no problem building good cars.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you about one of the most difficult things about buying a car, and that is shopping for it. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Jack Gillis, who has just completed a new 1988 edition of the Car Book, which is a guide for shopping domestic and import cars. He's also completed the 1988 version of the Used Car Book, a guide to shopping for used cars. Gillis is also the Director of Public Affairs for the Consumer Federation of America. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Jack Gillis, author of The Car Book and The Used Car Book, is my guest. Jack, I think for the remainder of the interview, instead of question and answer, we should negotiate.
All right.
This will be talking about shopping. I really can't understand why you buy a coat and you pay the price tag. You buy, you buy a toaster oven and there's a price and you pay the price. You buy a car and there's like $1,000 or more margin that you can negotiate in, and you never know for sure if you're getting a great buy or if you're getting totally swindled. Why aren't there prices, hard and fast prices, like there are for most things in this world?
Well, there's a phenomenon in America that, as you suggest, we pay for everything based on its list price. But that phenomenon falls apart in the auto showroom. It's one of the few products that we Americans purchase that we negotiate for. And the problem is we're inexperienced at negotiation. We don't like negotiating. And we're matching wits with a seasoned professional. So the odds are against us in today's showroom in getting the best price. But there are a few things consumers can do. And basically, I have three main, very simple suggestions. First, never narrow your choice down to one car. Always pick two or three. And that's not as hard as it may sound, because today's cars are really more similar than they are dissimilar. Because once you've narrowed your choice down to one car, you lose that psychological advantage to be able to walk away from the deal. And which brings me to point number two. You always have to be prepared to do what I call the 180-degree turn. Always be ready to walk away from a deal. Even if the salesperson assures you that this is the very last model of its type, you'll never see another one like this, they're hard to get, believe me, in today's automobile market, there'll always be another one.
And chances are this person might come down in price, the dealer might come down in price once they see you turning around.
Absolutely. The minute you're prepared to walk out of that showroom, not only do you if you exhibit that attitude during the process, and I'm not saying this is going to be easy, because again, it's an intimidating situation for most of us, but if you try to exhibit that attitude and you are truly prepared to walk away if they won't accept your deal, then you'll always maintain the upper hand in the negotiation. The final tip is to find out how much the dealer paid for the car and negotiate up from that price rather than down from retail.
No, I think that's great advice, and I really can't figure out how to get a price like that. Once you know what the dealer paid, then you can figure out what their margin of profit is, and you can negotiate along with them. But it's very difficult to really find out what the price they paid for that car is.
Well, it's getting easier and easier. For example, there's a publication that's available in most bookstores and libraries called Edmunds New Car Prices, and that will list the dealer cost of the car and the retail cost of the car, plus many of the options. Now, this particular publication is updated every quarter, and it's not as accurate as other sources, but it at least gives you a ballpark range. The second great source for this type of information would be from Consumer Reports Auto Buying Service. Now, this is something that you have to pay $10 per car for, but the company will send you a computer printout of the car, its dealer cost, and the cost of the options, as well as the dealer cost of the options. Also, many dealers now are advertising that they sell for what they call their invoice price. Now, beware, because the invoice price may include a bunch of options for which there's a high markup in, but oftentimes you will be able to actually get the dealer to show you the invoice.
I'm going to play dealer a second, okay? Jack, are you ready to buy today?
I'm ready.
Is that a good thing to say, that you're ready?
Sure.
Why?
Be very straightforward with the person and be prepared to buy if they meet your deal. The follow-up is, I'm ready to buy today if you will accept my offer.
Well, Jack,
no,
is there a price that I can beat that will ensure that you will buy today?
I'm willing to pay you $300 over the dealer cost of this particular car. Now, I happen to know this car cost you $12,000, so I'm prepared to write a check right now or arrange for the financing right now for $12,300. Would you accept my offer?
Okay, now I'm going to tell you that your price is wrong, and that actually the car cost me a lot more than you said it is, and that, you know, these magazines and reports aren't updated often enough, and they misquoted the price. And
well,
I'm going to have to charge you more than that.
Well, that may be true. Can you show me the invoice that indicates exactly how much you paid the dealer, the manufacturer, for this car? If I'm wrong, I'm willing to see your invoice and still pay you the $300 above your invoice cost.
Good. Okay. Now, one of the first things you're asked when you step into a showroom is, are you trading in your old car? Is this information that you should supply the dealer right away?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Well, keep in mind that you have three things that you're purchasing here. First of all, you're buying a new car, you're selling your old car, and you're arranging for financing. The dealer will want to throw all that into a pot and say, well, listen, would you like to pay $200 a month for this car? I can give it to you for $200 a month. Right there, you've made a determination on how much he's getting for the car, how much he's giving you for the trade-in, and how much you're going to pay in terms of finance costs. But you have no idea what those individual costs are. So what I suggest is you say you may or may not be interested in trading your car in. First, you want to negotiate the price of the new car. Then you'll sit down and negotiate the trade-in value of your used car, which you may choose not to trade in because you'll always do better selling it yourself. And then finally, you'll negotiate financing. And there, you have to shop around for financing just like you shopped around for your initial decision on which car to buy.
Now, the dealer is going to want to price the car that you're selling first before talking about the price of the new car. You're recommending the opposite order, that you price out the new car and then negotiate the trade on your car. Why is that order preferable?
Well, because your first goal really is to buy a new car. And in fact, I don't even recommend that you indicate that you're selling your used car, or, you know, try not to bring that into the discussion, because again, the dealer will keep that in the back of their mind when they're negotiating the price for the new car. So again, your first objective and your most difficult objective is to get that new car for the lowest possible price. That's why I suggest get that out of the way first and then make the choice to trade in. Now, again, keep in mind, if you choose to trade in your used car, you will only get, if the dealer is operating fairly with you, the wholesale price for that particular car. So if you look in what is called the Blue Book, which is available in most libraries and maybe at your bank, you can see the difference between the wholesale price and the retail price for your particular used car. And that difference is what you could make if you chose to sell it yourself. Now, you may decide that $250 or $300 difference isn't worth the hassle of trying to sell it yourself, so you'll be more than happy to trade it in. But you have to know both of those figures before you trade it in to ensure the dealer is giving you a fair value for the car.
Okay, so you'd really recommend saying, well, I don't think I'm going to trade my car, and then after you've gotten a good price on the new car, say, well, I changed my mind, I will trade in my new car,
absolutely,
my old car.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Now, a dealer will frequently say to you, I have this great price that I think I can get you, but I have to go check with the boss. And in order for me to actually get you this great price, I'm going to need a check, a deposit from you, to show your willingness to buy, to show your commitment. Otherwise, he's going to laugh me out of the office. So Jack, give me a deposit before I go ask about this price.
Sure, no problem. That's one of the oldest techniques in the world. And what I suggest is don't hesitate to write out a check. Don't make it for more than $100. But simply write out a check for $100, and if the offer is not accepted, just ask for your check back.
Will you get it?
Yes, you will. I can imagine there may be some totally disreputable dealers, and I'm probably one of the hardest guys on dealers in the country, but I doubt if anyone wouldn't give you your check back.
So this isn't a big deal scam?
Absolutely. But the scam, though, is I've got to go talk with the manager. It would be great if you could follow that person back, and you'll find that probably 9 times out of 10, they're having a cup of coffee, they're calling one of their friends, they're making you wait. It's become a big game now. And the longer you wait, the more likely you will be to acquiesce to their offer just to get this very difficult and anxiety-producing process over with.
Are the dealer undercoating and rust-proofing processes worth getting?
Absolutely not. In fact, some of the manufacturers, including Toyota, specifically recommend against rust-proofing. The very holes where the rust-proofing is injected into the car are actually the items that are most likely to begin rusting.
But most of the cars come with that as part of the dealer prep.
Then don't take it, because rust-proofing is extraordinarily expensive, and for my money, it's not worth it. Today's new cars have excellent corrosion warranties. Chrysler products, for example, are warranted for up to 7 years against surface penetration of rust on the outer body panels. So rust proofing is, you know, there's a couple of problems with it in addition to being overpriced. Secondly, it's duplicative. Thirdly, you often have to pay a regular annual checkup fee to keep the rust-proofing warranty in effect. And fourthly, by its very nature, that car has already picked up some corrosive materials the moment it leaves the factory. So if you rust-proof or undercoat afterwards, you may in fact be sealing in corrosive materials.
So now we're talking about the dealer rust-proofing, but you don't recommend private rust-proofing anymore, do you?
Either. Dealer rust-proofing or private rust-proofing.
Okay. Any kind of paint protection you recommend?
Absolutely not. again, manufacturers have done a great job putting paint on cars. After 3 years, start waxing your car. For a half hour's time, half three-quarters of an hour's time during the day, you can do far more to protect your paint than these plastic sealants, which have to be replaced every so often at a high expense. Fabric sealant is another big scam. It'll cost you anywhere from $79 to $129 to have the fabric in your car, so-called soil protected. I recommend you spend $5.95 on a can of Scotch Guard. That's exactly the same thing.
We only have a few seconds left, but are you good at this? When it's time for you to buy a new car, can you walk in there sure of yourself, confident, and negotiate a real good deal?
Absolutely not. It's a difficult process. And unfortunately, however, when I walk into a showroom, and I recently had this experience, I'm a challenge to these guys. So I have an even worse experience than the average consumer.
What, you threaten them, you mean?
Well, because here I come in as, you know, having been known as telling consumers how to buy cars cheaply, they're going to say, well, he's not going to get us down in price. We're really going to stick it to this guy. Well, he's a challenge to us.
Oh, so just one last thing. When you're shopping a car and they say, so, Mr. Gillis, what do you do for a living? Do you tell them, well, I write the car book?
That's the problem. Unfortunately, they already know that.
I see. Okay. Well, thanks very much for sharing some of your findings with us. Thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
My guest has been Jack Gillis, and his new editions of The Car Book and The Used Car Book, the 1988 editions, have just been published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.